So it was my first week back teaching at school and all the whirlwind that that involves. And so if some of you in here are teachers or at least go into school so you know how the program is, but the first thing on my agenda, first day of school, even really starts orientation, is making it pretty clear who's running this show. Is this a free-for-all, or is there somebody in charge here? And so that's something that has to be put in place, and there's no confusion there of what the boundaries are, what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do, and so on and so on. And so we're going to be talking about the sovereignty of God today, and you know that's a very finite human example of very limited scope of sovereignty. In that example, I'd be the sovereign person in the classroom. I'd say what goes, what doesn't go. I'm leading it in a direction. I even give them freedom in a variety of different ways. I let them know what the consequences will be if they choose to disobey, so on and so on. Even assignments, they'll have a degree of freedom of, do you want to do this project, or this project? They can choose, but guess what? I've boxed it in. You got to choose one of those. So, you know, on a much more intricate and grander scale, I believe we'll see from the passage we're going to examine today that God's sovereignty has some comparison, but again, on an infinite scale, much more complex in different ways. But he gives us freedoms, he gives us options, and he's also set up boundaries in which, there's no threat to whether, at the end of the day, God's still God and whether his plan is going to be fulfilled. That's never in question. And a lot of those concerns, in my opinion, come up when people elevate humans and themselves really to a level that's really not in touch with reality. I think what we're going to see is human freedom is not in any way, shape, or form a threat to God. And if you've made it such, you're really kind of, thinking of yourself a little bit more highly than you should, in my opinion. So looking at a definition, definitions can be a little squirrely. And I guess my warning for this is if you don't like the definition, that's fine. I don't even know if I like every part of it, but I'd like you to take more away from the scriptural examples we look at, because some of these things can be a little bit tricky to get a succinct definition that's also accurate. So what it is, sovereignty of God is the biblical teaching that all things are under God's rule and that nothing happens without his direction or permission. God works all things according to the counsel of his will. Ephesians 1:11. And one of the, for the first part of where we're going today, we'll be having some concerns with, I mentioned there's have been quite a few that have elevated in their own mind the impact that humans can have with regards to God's plan, think a little bit too highly of themselves and what humans can do. And it needs to be made clear, like I said, God set up the boundaries. He's given us freedom, and that is in no way a challenge to his sovereignty. He gets done exactly what he wants to get done, and that human freedom is not a threat to that. But because of those concerns, many people have taken it to an extreme of, like we have in Ephesians 1:11, is that God works all things together according to his plan. So what we'd see there is an orchestration, not a causation, and that's where they take it, is God causes all things. And so that's going to turn in very quickly to, as you can imagine, God causes sin. So when we sin, whose fault is it? Is it our fault or is it God's fault? There's only one right answer to that according to the Bible. It's our fault. So we have to keep that in check that, yes, he's working all things together, but that doesn't mean he's causing all things. It doesn't mean he's causing us to sin. There's only one person to blame when we sin, and it's us. So, just as a heads up, that's where we're going. And hopefully the purpose of this is to recognize the reality of God's sovereignty, and that it will lead us to, first, humility, put us in our place. Secondly, to give us confidence that when we look to God's promises, we know that he's good and he's loving and he's faithful, but is he powerful and is he able to live up to it and get it done? And the answer is yes. So we should have confidence in God's promises. And then finally, it should lead us to obedience. God's going to get done what his plans and purposes are, but the question is, do we want to be hitting our heads up against the wall as he's doing his thing, or do we want to be a part of his program and co-laborers with him? So, along lines of defining it, any understanding or definition of God's sovereignty must be in harmony with the scriptures and what they reveal about who he is. And so, it's not all of his attributes, but a spattering of some of his attributes. His omniscience, that he knows all things, that he is good. His justice, his omnipotence, he's all-powerful. His justice, holiness, love, wisdom, faithfulness, that he's merciful and gracious. These are all things that have to fit into the picture of how you look at and how you understand God's sovereignty. It's easy for us from our perspective to look at certain people in recent times, and it's become very, very popular, that elevate one attribute of God, they distort it, and then they put it so close to themselves that they refuse to really even acknowledge his other attributes. And it's most commonly done in today's age with God's attribute of love. So many examples of that, to where it's God's love, you know, to the extent where why do they stop forgetting to even mention or even acknowledging such things as sin, our need for salvation, such things as his justice, his holiness, on and on and on. And this is a concern that when we look at God's attributes, one of them being that he's sovereign, we're going to see this concern, and I'm going to suggest that some of the false teaching in regard to God's sovereignty is because of this problem. But have any of you guys seen Babylon Bee? Familiar with that? It's a satire site, so this isn't real, but there's a germ of truth in it, and that's why it's usually comical. But one character in recent times who's had this problem of, in my opinion, this is what's going on, in addition to other things, of taking the attribute of God's love, distorting it, holding it above everything else, and that's all you want to look and talk about, would be Mr. Rob Bell. So that guy, if you recall, was, he wrote, I believe it was called Love Wins. And it's like, well, actually God wins is the correct answer to that. But the point was, is he would only focus on the attribute of God being love and ignore everything else. And that gets you into false doctrine. So their article they had on him is Rob Bell runs out of doctrines to deny. And like that was a problem for him. But anyway, point is this is a concern when we look at God's attribute of sovereignty. I'm going to strongly suggest this has happened in many different circles where they take this one doctrine, that's all they want to see, to the detriment and even denial of some of his other attributes. And that's something that we need to definitely steer clear from. Now, give the same warnings each time. Just so you know, I'm not here as the final say on anything. You need to be a Berean. You need to be looking to the scriptures to see whether anyone says is true. And that's what we're supposed to be doing. The Bereans, they receive the word with all eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. Even questioning the big name people like Paul and Silas in this case. So they didn't just say, well, Paul said it, so whatever, we'll just roll with it. They checked it out, and they're commended for that. So that should be our practice as well. So you should be checking out what I say, what anyone says. What we should not be doing, on the flip side, Paul had to deal with these divisions in 1 Corinthians 3 with believers. And we have this where one's saying, well, I follow Paul, another, I follow Apollos. And he's saying, aren't you being pretty carnal and fleshly? He says, yes, you are. And this is exactly what we fall into when we get into this, well, so-and-so says, so how could so-and-so be wrong? Well, so-and-so big name says, we're not supposed to be following people. So, you know, if it feels a little bit of a sting of some of the guys, the quotes I'm going to bring up about their distortion of God's sovereignty, I'm not attacking you. I'm not even intending to attack them. Attacking their false teaching, and it would be a good time reflection. Are we following people or are we following the Bible? So, going on to our next section of what is not, and I'm going to try and go as quickly through this as I can because this isn't the whole purpose. I feel like I need to bring it up because there's so much distortion and confusion here that we need to contrast it with what the Bible's saying with what a lot of the teaching is out there. So the first thing to cover here is we need to talk about the man behind the man. So we're going to get to the man that has definitely shaped predominantly the thinking of topic of the sovereignty of God. But it's important, in my opinion, to look at, well, who is his influence? Who is his go-to guy? Who is his crutch? Who is his main teacher? And who was the guy that he leaned on, unfortunately? And so I'm not going to give you the name of this guy. You're probably going to figure out pretty soon. But his crutch was the founder of the Roman Catholic Church. This guy used the allegorical method to interpret Scripture, which in my opinion is that's possibly the worst thing you could do if you want to actually understand the Bible. It becomes a willy-nilly, what does it mean to you? What do you feel about this? What do you think this represents? On and on and on. If you stick to the literal, historical, grammatical method, it does box you in, and that's a good thing, because we shouldn't be creating a theology or Christianity of our own making. We should be learning from the text. Denied the necessity of viewing 6 days of creation as literal 24-hour days. A lot of people, he was inconsistent on this. A lot of people, unfortunately, appeal to him, and they're like, oh, well, he actually changed once he adopted the allegorical method. He rejected premillennialism for amillennialism. There's lots of ramifications of that. He confused the church with the kingdom, and thus he was not capable of seeing a distinction between Israel and the church. Causes all kinds of problems. He did not know Hebrew or Greek, nor did he care to. He actually tried to get Jerome, who was skilled in languages, who's like, God, leave that Hebrew alone. We don't need any of that. I'm like, okay, that's not helpful. Made every attempt to synthesize pagan philosophy of Christianity. So the majority of his life was spent being steeped in pagan philosophy, and it's been well documented that that was what he was trying to incorporate into Christianity. Accepted the Apocrypha as canonical. He held to the transubstantiation view of the Lord's Supper because of his allegorical method. Held to baptismal regeneration. And I'm not going to beat around the bush. That is work salvation. If you think any differently, then I'll have some words for you later. innovator of infant baptism. All infants not baptized were damned. Very clear on that in his opinion. Also work salvation. Taught the false doctrine of purgatory, taught that Mary was sinless and promoted worship of her, supported the intercession of the saints, promoted the adoration of relics, first to define so-called sacraments as a visible sign of invisible grace. Ever hear that one? This is where it started. And viewed them as necessary for salvation. Held to apostolic succession of bishops, first to assert the authority of tradition of the church in interpretation of the Bible, you know, key foundation of the Catholic Church. Unbiblical views on marriage, which led to positions of pre-celibacy and monasticism. So, without going into too much detail, he viewed where we get the priestly celibacy is he viewed any kind of intimacy, even in marriage, as shameful. And that goes back to his past problems, but that's not what the Bible teaches. Used Luke 14:23 to justify persecuting those who would dare disagree with him. And you cannot overestimate the impact that this had on the future of the face of Christianity. It was incredibly detrimental. Taught a theocracy through papal supremacy over secular governors, which led to the Crusades. This is the foundation of that. He believed assurance of salvation was impossible and that it was immoral to presume you are saved. And I still hear that from people today. I think we're about done. Okay, that was the last one. And the final thing, there's so many things in there. He also is very well known for this concern here of taking his distorted view of sovereignty and lifting it above all else to the detriment of God's other attributes, even the denial of some. Anyone know who this guy is? Huh? Close. But no. Ends with a steen. Augustine. So it blows my mind that all I hear about this guy from people is praise, but he is the founder of the Roman Catholic Church, and in my opinion, there has been no one that's been a greater detriment to the face of Christianity than this man. You could argue that Constantine as well, but I would argue he's probably not even a believer. But anyway, this is the man behind the man. And who do we think the man is in terms of who gives us the biggest in-your-face picture of what sovereignty of God is? What if I told you that St. Augustine embodied everything wrong with Catholicism, and John Calvin was his biggest fanboy, quoting him 1,706 times. There was an individual did his whole doctoral dissertation on Calvin's usage of the church fathers, and before you think, well, no, he was probably just arguing with him, right? Nope, not quite. Most of those quotations were favorable. You can find quotations of Calvin saying of Augustine that he was a holy man, holy father, that Augustine embodied the purest form of the church fathers of holding to sound doctrine and sound teaching. Not quite. So what's important when we look at these quotes from Calvin is that he wasn't studying the Bible and was back in a vacuum. Most of his training was coming from Catholic tradition, and he was heavily reliant on Augustine. So our first quote from John Calvin, and here we see his humility. "No one will ever attempt to disprove the doctrine which I have set forth herein, but he who imagined himself to be wiser than the Spirit of God." Let me say before we start, I do not think I'm wiser than the Spirit of God, but I will be disagreeing with his interpretation of things. This poor guy needed to switch to decaf. So, when we're looking at this, I am not denying the sovereignty of God, but this is all you get. If you question John Calvin, de facto, boom. Oh, you don't believe in the sovereignty of God. Well, this is the face you're usually going to see from me if you go that route. And Calvinists accuse you of not holding the sovereignty of God because you refuse to believe that God is the author of sin. Now, consistency is a huge problem here. Yes, you can find some quotes from Calvin that will say, oh, God's not the author of sin. But for every one of those, there's a dozen or more that explicitly explain that reality, that that's what he believes, which we're going to look at. First one, from one of his books on concerning the eternal predestination of God. "It's easy to conclude how foolish and frail is the support of divine justice by the suggestion that evils come to be not by his will, but merely by his permission." So he thinks that's a horrible idea, that God has given people freedom and that they choose to sin. "But it is quite frivolous refuge to say that God idly permits them when Scripture shows him not only willing, but the author of them." I disagree. Thus says John Calvin, "I have already shown clearly enough that God is the author of all those things which, according to these objectors, happen only by inactive permission. He testifies that he creates light and darkness, forms good and evil, that no evil happens which he hath not done." If you want to, afterwards, I could share the verses where he's distorting from this, and it would have been very helpful if he would have studied Hebrew a little bit more before he spouts these things off, because it is right down silly. Thus says John Calvin, "I freely acknowledge my doctrine to be this, that Adam fell not only by the permission of God, but by his very secret counsel and decree." Well, isn't that nice that John Calvin has this insight into God's very secret will that you other peon believers don't have access to? Have we ever heard of Gnosticism? Secret knowledge out there that the little guys down the totem pole just don't have access to. But thankfully, John Calvin did. Now, when I talk about denying other doctrines, most people are completely unaware of this. Those following in Calvin's tradition on this point, and they still do to this day, deny God's omniscience. How many of you would ever imagine? That's what we're going to see here. I'll just let you see the quote, sorry. "God foresees future events only by reason of the fact that he decreed they take place." We're going to see what that means in a minute. It's saying that if God wasn't powerful enough to force it to come about, he wouldn't know it. That's not omniscience. And some of his followers here, spelling out even more in the last century, if God did not foreordain all things, then he could not know the future. God foreknows and knows all things only because he decreed all things to be. That is an outright denial of omniscience. When we talk about omniscience, we're saying God knows all things, past, present, future, and hypothetical. We've talked about Jesus speaking of you know, woe is you, Tyre and Sidon. If Sodom and Gomorrah had seen these signs, they would have repented. How does he know even hypothetical things? Because he's not like us. He's omniscient. He has knowledge that is independent of what he forces to come about. When we try and make him like us, this is the kind of garbage we get into. That's the only way we could know the future, is if we force it. God is not like that. And his direct pupil that studied under Calvin, Theodore Beza, the fall of man was both necessary and wonderful. Is the fall of man wonderful? Isaiah 5:20, woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Again, we need to be concerned about, are we placing one attribute of God, distorting it, and to the detriment of the Scripture's teaching on his other attributes? Because make no qualms about it. Whether he denied it at other points and whether these followers denied other points, they were teaching that God is the author of sin. And if that's not an affront to his holiness, I don't know what is. So I'm also going to go through this as quickly as possible, because this is not the main point of what we're dealing with. But talking about earlier on of Augustine reading philosophy into the Scriptures as his program of how he interprets things, you have to just recognize that's the way they operate. And so we do have some responses to that, kind of in a tit for tat, that even philosophically this doesn't make any sense. So universal causal determinism cannot offer a coherent interpretation of Scripture. So we're just going to run through these. First, people face a multitude of divine exhortations. Doesn't make any sense under divine causal determinism. People are said to obey, believe, and choose God. Is Scripture lying in that? Is it being deceptive? No. People sin and rebel against God. Did God cause them to rebel and then get angry that they did exactly as he programmed them to do? A little bit silly. People's sins are judged by God. Would that be just to punish something, if you even call it a someone, doesn't even really make sense in their view, to punish a robot for what they've been programmed to do? Does that make any sense? People are tested by God. Does that make any sense, if he's causing them to do all that happens? People receive divine rewards. People are responsible to respond to God's initiative. Prayers are not mere showpieces scripted by God. What a sham our prayer lives are if causal determinism is true. What a sham. God literally pleads with sinners to be saved. If he's causing them to rebel, why is he also pleading with them? You see the schizophrenia here. God is not a psychopath. That's not the picture that the Bible presents of God. Second reason. Universal causal determinism cannot be rationally affirmed. I'll also read through this quickly. This is coming from William Lane Craig, and I don't know that much about him, so I'm not, again, I'm telling you to check out everything. So, but anyway, these quotes do come from him. There is a sort of dizzying, self-defeating character to determinism. For if one comes to believe that determinism is true, one has to believe that the reason he has come to believe it is simply that he was determined to do so. One has not, in fact, been able to weigh the arguments pro and con and freely make up one's mind on that basis. The difference between the person who weighs the arguments for determinism and rejects them and the person who weighs them and accepts them is wholly that one was determined by causal factors outside himself to believe and the other not to believe. When you come to realize that your decision to believe in determinism was itself determined, and that even your present realization of that fact right now is likewise determined, a sort of vertigo sets in. For everything that you think, even this very thought itself, is outside your control. It is very hard to see how causal determinism could ever be rationally affirmed, since its affirmation undermines the rationality of its affirmation. So if you want to buy into this, number one rule is turn your brain off, because you won't be using it. Three, universal causal determinism makes God the author of sin and precludes human responsibility. This is the number one concern I have with this, is God is holy. He is not the author of sin. When we sin, it is our fault, not God's fault. you've heard about people, oh, the devil made me do it. The new Calvinist way of saying it, well, God made me do it. Is that any better? That's blasphemy. And the deterministic view, even the movement of the human will is caused by God. God moves people to choose evil, and they cannot do otherwise. God determines their choices and makes them do wrong. If it is evil to make another person do wrong, then on this view, God is not only the cause of sin and evil, but becomes evil himself, which is absurd. By the same token, all human responsibility for sin has been removed, for our choices are not really up to us. God causes us to make them. We cannot be responsible for our actions, for nothing we think or do is up to us. And yes, I have read Romans 9, and if you ask me about that, first question you're going to get is, what are the passages that it's referring to in the Old Testament? So come prepared. Number four, universal causal determinism makes reality into a farce. On the deterministic view, the whole world becomes a vain and empty spectacle. There are no free agents in rebellion against God, whom God seeks to win through his love, and no one who freely responds to that love and freely gives his love and praise to God in return. The whole spectacle is a charade, whose only real actor is God himself. Far from glorifying God, the causal deterministic view, I'm convinced, denigrates God for engaging in such a farcical charade. It is deeply insulting to God to think that he would create beings which are in every respect causally determined by him and then treat them as though they were free agents, punishing them for wrong actions he made them do or loving them as though they were freely responding agents. God would be like a child who sets up his toy soldiers and moves them about his play world, pretending that they are real persons whose every motion is not, in fact, of his own doing, and pretending that they merit praise or blame. Again, are we letting the scriptures tell us about God's sovereignty? Or are we developing, well, how would it work if we were sovereign? Bad idea. God is not like us. So now, rant is over. We're moving on to the scriptural examples. And this is what I want to be key. Like I said, may take or leave the definition that, you know, take the good points if there's bad, leave it. We really want to see how this is played out in scriptural examples. And the first place I want to look is Genesis 50, verses 15 through 21. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin, because they did evil to you." Who did evil to you? Did God do evil to you? They did evil to you. "And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones." Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So we see very clearly here, it is not God causing these human agents to sin against Joseph. He is not morally responsible for the evil actions they took against him. But does he work in all these things, that even in these bad things he can bring about his purposes? You better believe it. But you better not be taking the illogical step of, well, he caused all of them. He caused those people to sin. They couldn't have done otherwise. It's always comical to me every time I think about it, all the times that we saw how things were not going very pleasantly for Joseph, and in each of those circumstances said, "And the Lord is with him." The joke is, you know, commentators said, Joseph's probably thinking, "Can you go be with someone else for a little while? Because this is a little rough." So even when you're doing what you're supposed to, we're not teaching a prosperity gospel, you will encounter suffering. But the truth of the good message of how God is working in our lives is that even these bad things that occur, God can redeem those things. And that's incredible. It's not very incredible if he's participating in sin and causing people to sin, that's not very awe-inspiring. It sounds very human and depraved. But here we see a picture of how God works all things together according to his plan. Next spot, Genesis 11, Tower of Babel encounter here. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words, and as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we should be dispersed over the face of the whole earth." So they knew full well what they were supposed to be doing, but God gave them their degree of freedom within the boundaries to make some decisions, and they're choosing poorly here. Does that mean God's not sovereign anymore? They did something that he desired that they not do. Does that mean he's no longer sovereign? We're about to find out. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down, and there confuse their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of the earth. So God's plan is that man be dispersed throughout all the earth, right? Did God give man a degree of freedom within the boundaries to make some decisions? Yes. Did this group decide to rebel against it? Yes. Is God still sovereign? Yes. And here we see a very clear picture that I want you to take home of God has his plan. Your responsibility is to be sure you're playing on the right team and that you're co-laboring with him, that you can be blessed and not hitting your head up against the wall. We're still dealing with the effects of this language confusion. I've always said, man, if I could, all the time I have to spend studying languages, it's like, man, if I saw the guy that was the ringleader for this event, I'd want to bop him in the nose because he's caused a lot of problems out here. But we see God's going to get done what he wants to get done. The question is, are you going to be hitting your head up against the wall? Are you going to be experiencing the carrot or the stick on this situation? Another individual who chose to rebel against God and experienced the stick, King Nebuchadnezzar. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. And the king answered and said, "Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power, as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty?" While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven, "O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you, and you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will." Immediately the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from among men and ate grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers, and his nails were like bird's claws. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever, for his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" At the same time, my reason returned, and the glory of my kingdom, majesty, and splendor returned to me. My counselors and my lord sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are right, and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride he is able to humble. So this is a great picture of what not to do, and then the proper response once you've been humbled is that God is in control, you are not in charge. Once you get this attitude of, wow, I must really be great stuff, that's just the time that you're going to experience the sovereignty of God in a very humbling manner. So the question is, do you want to experience that? God's going to do what he's going to do. He's going to get done what he's going to get done. What do you want your experience in all this to be? Do you want to be hitting your head up against the wall your whole life, or do you want to be coming on board and working along with his purposes? Final example, Acts 2, 22 through 24. Peter speaking in a sermon. Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst. As you yourselves know, this Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death, because it was not possible for him to be held by it. So here we see again, quotes from the gentleman before, they would like to tell you that God doesn't have foreknowledge. He only knows because he's going to force it to come about. Again, not true. We can see from Scripture that God knows all things, even the hypothetical things. So even if you chose to do differently, he'd know how things would work out and so on and so on. And so he has a definite plan that he's working out. And because of his foreknowledge of how we will choose to do things and so on and so on, he can orchestrate this plan, not cause, but he can work within our freedom and decisions to bring about his purposes. And guess what? We're no threat to that. If you think that human freedom can threaten the sovereignty of God, you have severely overestimated the ability of humans. Again, analogies are never perfect or great, but it'd be similar in some capacity to you having a little ant farm that's sealed very, very well, and you give them the freedom to roam around about their business. Is that a threat to your humanity? Are those ants going to thwart your plans as a human and, you know, somehow make you no longer human? No, that's silly. In the same way, human freedom is in no way a challenge to the sovereignty of God. To treat it as such is very demeaning to God, and it's just wrong. Proper responses to God's sovereignty. First place I want to look is James 4. James speaking, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. And so that should be our mindset of God's going to, he has his plan. He's going to work it out. He's in charge of that. I don't know what the future is and, you know, different details. We know some big picture end game details, but we don't know everything. And so that should be your attitude. And again, as you probably know, you don't have to say this every time you make plans, but this should be your heart attitude of, well, you know, I don't know what God has in store, but, you know, Lord willing, this is my finite plans here. And that should be your attitude of humility. That should give us confidence in God, specifically, like I said, looking at God's promises that he's made to us. So not only is he good, not only is he holy, not only is he merciful and gracious and he's faithful, but he's powerful and he is sovereign to get done that which he has promised to do. And so we look here at a promise here, looking at his power. Jesus speaking, my sheep hear my voice and I know them and they follow me. I give them eternal life and they will never perish. And no one will snatch them out of my hand. My Father, who has given them to me, is greater than all. And no one is able to snatch them out of my Father's hand. So I talk about this verse with regard to eternal security. People have this idea of like, well, man, I could really do something to mess this up. I know Jesus promised that he's going to get me there because of what he's done, but surely I could do something to mess this up. Or Arminians will be like, oh, I could choose to walk away. False. If you want to say that you are stronger than God, that's your own problem. Otherwise, there's only one option here. There is none greater than God. If he's saying this is what's going to happen, this is what's going to happen. And that should give you a confidence in God's promises. Finally, it should lead us to obedience. Again, you don't need to be speculating on, well, what in detail is he going to be doing with this, you know, in plans, and am I still going to be living here next year or doing this, or what's going to happen with my work or whatever? You really don't need to worry about that. God's in control is the bottom line. Here's what we do need to be worrying about. Micah 6:8, he has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? So when it comes down to the simple application of it, even the whole system of the Mosaic law, what did it all come down to as a summary? All the laws hang on two things: love God, love your neighbor. We really see this demonstrated here. Do justice and to love kindness as relating to your neighbor, and to walk humbly with your God, to love the Lord with all your heart. And this is our responsibility. If you focus on this, you don't need to be concerning yourself, because we don't know what ultimately in specific details what God has planned. And that's really not our concern. All we need to know is that he is good, he is faithful, he is just, and he is sovereign. He is in control. So hopefully you don't feel too beat up. Again, you're free to disagree with me. I'm just Joe Blow Levi. But I would encourage you to not fall into the trap of, well, so-and-so big name said, so-and-so big name said. Very, very bad pitfall that has led to a lot of perpetuation of false doctrine, in my opinion. So again, take God at his word. Let this be a humbling doctrine that leads you to obedience.